The Guardian.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that gives you the power of beautiful design. So you can do more than create a website, you can set yourself apart. To start your free trial, visit squarespace.com/guardian.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. Coming up on the show, we travel inside the mind of the legendary mathematician John Conway, whose life has been engaged with myriad issues from geometry, symmetry and game theory to inventing recreational games and discovering surreal numbers. He sheds light on the true nature of numbers, the beauty lying within maths, and why game playing is so important to mathematical discovery. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. John Conway is Emeritus Professor of Mathematics at Princeton University. He's a mathematician widely known for his contributions to game theory, finite groups, knot theory, number theory, and coding theory. No, I don't know what they all are either. He's also devised many recreational maths games, including the Game of Life Cellular Automaton, which brilliantly demonstrates how simplicity can generate complexity. His life story is told in a new biography, Genius at Work, The Curious Mind of John Horton Conway, by the science journalist and author Siobhan Roberts. I'm delighted to say that John and Siobhan join me in the studio. So whose idea was it to write a book about John Horton Conway?
I think it was this lady's.
Yes, indeed. I met John when I was actually writing my first book about Donald Coxeter, who was a geometer initially at Cambridge. And I went to interview John Conway about Coxeter. You know, I found you at math camp and you had no shoes on and you were, you know, dirty and smelly like all the campers and, you know, juggling and doing tricks. And I thought, aha, here is another book. So the bells went off right away.
And you're still both speaking to each other. And this was, I think, a six-year project. How was it for you both? Siobhan, you first.
It was a six-year project.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I had John on the brain for probably more than a decade. But it was, on the whole, it was a fairly amicable process. I mean, there were times when we came to blows. And then John has this thing where, you know, you shake pinkies and make up. And, you know, we're still friends.
There you are.
Yeah.
You are.
John, what's it like being biographied?
Well, this is really addressed to Siobhan because she has a nice phrase for describing it.
So I spent a lot of time at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. They were very generous in inviting me to be a visitor while I was working on the book. And John was across town at the university. And at the Institute, I met Heinrich von Staden, who is a historian of science, and he was working on a subject, vivisection, which is this ancient ritual of strapping a pig to a plank while it's alive and cutting it open and viewing the, you know, workings of its, you know, heart and all its internal workings while it's alive. And I sort of pondered in the prologue to the book that it must be sort of what it was like for John to have me, you know, dissecting his life and asking all these delicate questions.
It wasn't quite as bad as that, but I thought that was such a good story. Yes. Well, it was funny. Siobhan used to come. You know, I sit in the alcove, in an alcove, in the corridor, essentially outside my office in Princeton. That's because I can't get into the office. It's full of junk. And Siobhan would come and sit next to me with her damned tape recorder, which tiny little thing, you know, and get me to talk. I was always scared of that tape recorder. I'm inclined to let my tongue run loose a little bit.
The subject that you work on, the mathematics you work on, is tough to understand, and you have to. Isn't there just a nuisance factor of having someone come along that you have to explain an awful lot to, whereas you could be doing your own thing.
Yes. On the other hand, I like explaining things to people. I mean, it's my strength, really. I'm not so much a professional mathematician, I almost said magician there, as a professional teacher. You know, most of my life I've been in elite universities, Cambridge in England and Princeton in the States, teaching, you know, terribly bright students who are going to go away and become, you know, the professionals of the future and so on. But I really like explaining things to people not at that level who don't know mathematics or something. I don't mean to say that they're any worse, they're just not mathematicians or something.
It's interesting because John also calls himself a professional non-understander. And you have this thing where you're both a know-it-all, and you have this really promiscuous curiosity, and you're seeking to understand all these things that you don't know in an expert way. It made things accessible for me because I'm not a mathematician. I don't have a mathematical background. So sort of, you know, via John's modus operandi, just in terms of how he gains all this knowledge about the world, that's how I was able to approach, you know, all the things you're interested in, but also the mathematics. And it was interesting because I was interviewing lots of people at the university, and I asked one of John's colleagues, Peter Sarnak, how he would really distill down who John is. And he said, John is a seducer. And then he sort of revised it, and he said, he's the seducer. And he was speaking of John's ability, you know, in terms of teaching and this sort of intoxicating and enchanting effect he has, not only on students, but also colleagues and, you know, anyone on the street who you buttonhole and try and, you know, seize their attention and explain your latest obsession to.
I have a little saying about myself, quite a lot of my sayings about myself, which is that if it sits down, I'll teach it. If it stands up, I'll continue to teach it. But if it runs away, I may not be able to catch up. Well, in fact, nowadays, you know, even if it walks away quite slowly, I won't be able to catch up. But I'll try to continue teaching it, whatever it is.
One thing I thought that comes across very strongly in the book, Siobhan, is that, John, you're captivated by maths for a very long time. And I'm wondering, what is it about maths that holds you still?
Well, now it's changed. It's the desire to understand some very large things, infinite things in particular.
What was it like earlier when you started out? There's this.
You know, I started out at the age of four. That is what my mother says. She found me reciting the powers of two at the age of four. I don't know how far I got. It might have just been 1, 2, 4, 8. You know, mothers are quite fond of their children. Or it might have gone up to 1,024, I don't know. I also remember we used to go and see my granny every weekend. They used to dump me in the front room, which was the kind of granny's front room you never go into except on formal occasions, you know, and empty a jar of buttons and, you know, clever shiny things. And I used to arrange them on the carpet and make them into nice patterns.
I still don't have a feeling for what it is about maths that captivates you, though.
Well, perhaps that last thing tells you a little bit. I like pretty patterns. People don't sort of understand this, but mathematical things are really very beautiful. You know, well, for instance, during the part of my life wherein I met Coxeter and so on, famous geometer, I was studying geometry. I think of it as rather like Christmas tree ornaments. When you have some pleasant ornament with perhaps, you know, things sticking out of it and brightly coloured or whatever, and it turns round slowly, you can see it from different points of view every now and then. Quite a lot of Christmas tree ornaments are sort of based on the icosahedron, particular geometrical figure, which has threefold symmetries from one point of view and fivefold from another and so on. So I made my name, my mathematical name, studying a 24-dimensional object. Now, 24 dimensions is a lot richer than three, and you can find more beautiful things in it. You can't actually see them with your eyes, unfortunately, but you can interrogate them in various ways. That occupied a fair amount of my mathematical investigations at one time.
And is some of this a sense of when there is a problem to be solved, it is a search for something beautiful that solves it? That there is a part of you knowing that there'll be something elegant in there.
Problems to be solved, actually. I like staring at the beautiful things. However, there is a problem to be solved then, which is how do you stare at them if they're not in our space? The nature of mathematical existence has always intrigued me. You know, we live in a three-dimensional space, apparently, although there are doubts about that recently. Well, recently, meaning 20 years ago. You know, eight-dimensional space does not physically exist. So how is it that it's got interesting things in it? And what do you do to investigate them? Ontology, you know, the study of existence. It's a real problem for me. Well, here's a little problem that you might wonder about. Where is two, T-W-O, and where is three? What are they? many people say concepts, and they're confused, because a concept means something that's conceived. Incidentally, there's a thing, you know, what does conceive mean? It means to capture or grab together. When a woman conceives, she gets it together in her womb. When we conceive an idea, we get it together in our heads somehow. So what about two? Is two a concept? Well, no, because the statement that there are two satellites of Mars was true a long time before there were any people to say it or to conceive it. And I don't think the dinosaurs managed to conceive it at all, you know. Mm. Well, they certainly didn't, because Mars is too far away. So what is two? I think it's got real physical existence, but it doesn't have quite the same physical existence as a cat or a tree.
Well, I was going to ask you what numbers really are.
Yeah.
And this is what you're talking about, I suppose. And in the book, Siobhan, you talk about how, well, you have John talking about how numbers have this this obstinacy, that they can't be pushed around, that they're like cats, yeah, and maybe trees as well.
Right. I always compare mathematical questions of existence to the existence of cats, because the reason why I know a cat exists is because it doesn't do exist. How can I say it? It's not just in my mind or other people's minds in general. Cats are a real thing, and I know that because they're obstinate. You push them north and they insist on going south. It doesn't matter which direction you push them, they want to go in the other direction. They won't go where you push them. An artist or an author can make things do what he or she wants. You know, has control of the characters. So, you know, since I've been involved with mathematical things which exist in a less substantial sense than cats do, but they still have a catty kind of existence, they don't do what I want them to. They do their own thing, you know. Two and three don't make four, they make five. Unless I change the meanings of the words, I can't make them make four instead of five. That's what they do. And that obstinacy exists in a lot of things. You know, there are mathematicians who believe other things. I suppose I've been describing the philosophy of mathematics called Platonism, you know, which is the sort of doctrine that things really exist and so on. There are other philosophies of mathematics. Mm. I must say, I think more or less every mathematician is a Platonist, or the vast majority of them, but philosophers of mathematics are quite frequently saying other things. You know, when you live with these things for a time and discover things yourself, you're aware that you're not creating it.
You think maths is always a discovery rather than a creation?
Well, I was not saying always, because there are other people who think different things. Hmm. They're not such good mathematicians as I am.
But what do you think? Do you think maths is a discovery or an invention?
A discovery, always.
Right.
That's the Platonist point of view.
But there's
there are some very good mathematicians as well as philosophers of mathematics who have contrary points of view.
You can see how when you look at nature, you'll find, as you say, a couple of natural satellites around Mars. You'll find a Fibonacci sequence in flower arrangements, flower petals and so on.
The real place where you find Fibonacci sequences is in pine cones and pineapples.
Pine cones, okay. So you can
see
maths
find them
in
very much so in sunflowers. Oh, sunflowers are absolutely gorgeous.
So that is maths that's very real. You can see it there. You can see the numbers. You can touch the physical stuff of the sunflower. When you have these, what to me feel like incredibly elaborate, and I'll use the word constructions and shoot me down for it, but it's just the first thing that comes to my head, in zillions of dimensions, so they're exotic things to me. I'm wondering if you think some of these more exotic sort of objects or mathematical structures, if you like, whether they have any reality or connection with nature.
That's the problem. They often do.
Well, the monster, for example, and monstrous moonshine.
Siobhan, tell us about the... Some people listening won't know what the monster is.
Well, the monster is a... Maybe John should tell us what it is, but it's a very large group in the sort of mathematical ocean of symmetry.
So a group of numbers?
It's rather like the business of the Christmas tree ornaments. In mathematics, when something is symmetric, what symmetric means really is that you can look at it from a different viewpoint and it looks the same. Or you can look at it, the viewpoint might involve looking in a mirror. Certain things are symmetric. We study those symmetries. That's usually the subject called group theory, which was developed mathematically in the 19th century. Whoops, I was a group theorist for quite some time of my life and discovered a few new simple groups. Don't ask me what simple means. It's too complicated. that's how I made my mathematical name. The best group theorist in the world, a man called John Thompson, had just started spending 6 months of the year in Cambridge, England, and 6 months in Chicago, in the USA. Not Chicago in Lancashire. Anyway, I heard of this amazing configuration in 24-dimensional space. I wasn't a group theorist, but I was sort of reasonably competent mathematician. Anyway, I didn't think it was my job to study this group, that each lattice actually was the object. Told it to Thompson. I said, what can I do to persuade you to look at this one? And he said, you find the order. The order means the number of different symmetries. A cube has 48 different symmetries. You find the order, and I'll listen to you. At the time, I was in Cambridge. I hadn't got a college lectureship or university position even. And I already had four little girls and a wife, by the way. I was supporting them. Anyway, I worked out that I could afford to spend 6 hours a week, 6 hours on every Wednesday from 6 o'clock till midnight, and 12 hours every Saturday from noon till midnight working on this thing. I didn't know how long it would take. Mm. I thought it might go on for a year even, you know. But anyway, came the first Saturday. I kissed the little girls and the wife, I'm sure, goodbye. They were told not to disturb Daddy, and I went into the front room. At about six, I telephoned Thompson and said, I know the order to within a factor of two. It's either some 18-digit number or twice that 18-digit number. Mm. Then I said, but I feel so tired, I'm going to bed early. And then I didn't go to bed early. I sort of thought, oh, I might as well do a little bit more thinking, you know. And I telephoned him about six times, always with the same message. I'm going to bed now. I'm absolutely exhausted. And then I always thought, oh, no, I could just do such and such. And at 20 past 12 on that first Saturday, I telephoned him and I said, I've proved it exists, you know, which was the problem. That changed my life utterly. I was immediately catapulted into the jet set of mathematicians. When I did go to New York, I flew there, gave a 20-minute talk, and flew back again. And, you know, my life was just different from then on.
Mm. I wanted to get your thoughts on whether you've had any kind of overriding aim through your work, whether there's been any kind of particular theme or any kind of aim in this. When you take something on, is there something you have at heart where you're thinking, this is how I go at this, this is what I want to do?
No, I don't think so. I just do it.
Well, what about the problems you pick?
It's sort of strange. It's usually just understanding something. I want to understand something.
Certainly a good dose of your work has been very, very playful. Games have featured very strongly. But why games?
Well, I don't understand, for instance, chess. I've never been interested in chess. The reason I don't like chess is it's got these funny shaped pieces. There's this one like a horse that moves in this funny way that they move, you know, and this other one that looks like a castle and so on. You know, that's not mathematical. One could imagine all sorts of alternative chess sets, so to speak, and all sorts of different moves. Of course, people do, too. People who are interested in chess are often interested in these fairy chess games, they call them. For me, that's the reason to turn me off. Mm. I mean, I don't expect to be able to get a nice, elegant mathematical theory if there's all this junk around. I sort of think of it as junk. I had intended to consider the theory of adding games, and this sort of made me work out what that theory was, and I made the greatest discovery of my life there, which was the surreal numbers. Mm. The surreal numbers, enormous collection of numbers, but I got through them through playing games. Mm. Let me tell you about the game zero. It's quite amusing. Mm. In the game zero, there's only one position, which is the starting position, and it's illegal ever to make a move. If you don't make a move when it's your turn, you lose. You know, that's not a very interesting game to play.
Yeah.
However, it's an interesting game mathematically, because if you add zero to any other game, G, say, you get G. Oh, there's a mathematical theorem. Zero plus G, in the sense of game theory, is G. Well, that sounds like mathematics already, doesn't it? Mm. Very simple mathematics. But then there's a game I call one, in which left is the only player who has a legal move, and it's got to be the very first move of the game, and he moves to zero. There's one. And I found there were various other games that behaved like numbers. One plus G is greater than G, meaning that if left can win G, he can win one plus G. So you can prove theorems about games that sound really rather like theorems about numbers. Mm. But the astonishing discovery I made is that there are many more numbers in the game theory world than there hitherto were in this sort of number theory world.
It spawns numbers.
Yeah, masses of them. And those are these numbers called surreal numbers.
You've given a lot of talks in your time, and Siobhan, you talk about a lot of them in your book. One of the ones that I don't think you ever gave, but Douglas Hofstadter wanted you to give, was a talk that would touch on how you think your mind works. He was very excited about what he thought was going on inside your brain when you were being creative. What would you have said?
You talk of these white hot experiences.
Oh, yes, that's an interesting thing. However, a few times in my life, in particular when I found the surreal numbers, I had what I used to call the white hot period. And then I was thinking so intensively I couldn't sleep. And I would be awake for, 50 hours consecutively or something like that.
And this isn't caffeine-fueled. This isn't just a caffeine problem. It's the intensity of the thinking.
Yeah, it was just thinking. I couldn't, if I got into bed, I couldn't sleep. It was also, of course, intensely exciting. Adrenaline makes you scared.
Mm.
But it also turns you on, so to speak, in various ways. Mm. I don't mean turn you on sexually or anything. It's exciting.
But on this idea of the creativity, the white-hot periods, have you had any self-reflection of what is going on in your thinking as to how this might be going, how you're bringing together ideas that other people hadn't done? Or is it a brute force approach?
Well, it's always, I don't know why you make those antitheses. When I'm doing it, I don't think of anything else but whatever it is I'm doing.
I mean, a good friend of yours, Richard Guy, commented that he would agree that you're a creative genius, but he said, bottom line, John is doing math all the time, and you're doing it with your children crawling on top of you, and you're doing it while you're giving them a bath, and you're doing it on your way into work, and you go to work on Sundays. And so there's the, just the amount of time spent, and you really are sort of so in love with it that you never, you don't go on vacation.
That's true, I think, or at least it was true. I've slowed down. I'm still doing math. I'm still teaching math in various ways. I am, or at least I try to be, interested in everything, not just maths, everything, there is.
To get back to the idea of John the seducer, of course, when you read that in the book, you were pleased. And being a word nerd, he schooled me on the etymology of the word seduce. And so the root deuce or duct means to lead. And we happened to be on a train at the time. And he said, for example, a conductor leads the train. A deduction leads from one proposition to the next. A reduction leads back. And a seduction or a seducer leads one astray. And so that was, very much the experience of spending 8+ years with John. I would go to the alcove and try and talk about surreal numbers, and we would, go slide off
talking
on...
talking about seduction,
Well, or, just everything, slide off on all these tangents, and so...
Maths at the highest level seems incredibly arcane. I'm not sure I can think of a more exclusive pursuit, if you like. And two things. I'm wondering if it's not just an extraordinary luxury to spend your time solving problems for the sake of it. Isn't it kind of in some way a shame that all that brain power isn't used to do something with a more obvious use, or with something that's less out of reach of the vast majority of people?
Well, I don't know. I always used to feel guilty about the fact that society pays me for doing this thing that I love, And I've regarded my job as being a teacher rather than a professional mathematician. I suppose I'm saying that partly because I can see that is... useful to society. It is useful to have a whole lot of mathematicians educated. And you know, you don't educate people by telling them useful things. You educate people by telling them interesting things. You know, the students actually have the wrong idea. They often say, oh, how the worst students, when are we ever going to use this? If you teach them things that they're going to use, they're bored. They just drop off. If you teach them, you know, interesting things, then they learn it and then they can use it. A whole lot of mathematics is very useful, practically useful. That's not a good way to teach it. I can tell you I've been teaching this stuff for decades.
We purposefully haven't talked about Game of Life, which is probably still the thing you're most well known for.
Yes, I hate the Game of Life.
But what I am going to ask you to wrap up with is, never mind Game of Life, what are your rules for life?
Oh, for my life?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I don't know. You know, I'm very stupid. I wouldn't have had the stroke that you've observed I did have if I had taken note of what my doctor said. So I'm not very good at life, really. I'm amazed that I've survived so far. I'm now 77, damn nearly 78. So I don't know that it's much good giving you my rules for life. If you follow my rules for life, you will make a failure of it, you know. You'll end up having a stroke and various other things. I don't have any rules regarding my life. I sort of follow my nose.
Be interested.
Yes, I did say this. I've often used it. My rule for doing mathematics is to keep six balls in the air at any one time. That meant six sort of problems or areas to think about. And they range, well, now, for instance, they range from today's Sudoku puzzle to, say, working on the Riemann hypothesis, which is the standard still unsolved problem of mathematics, very difficult and deep. And then there are some intermediate ones.
You know, in terms of following your nose, that comes back again to the idea of being led astray and following one's curiosity. More often than not, a beautiful and profound piece of mathematics that starts in the pure realm does end up being applied. So, you know, I think that's the value and the power of having, you know, big brains doing these sort of unreachable things, is that they do, you know, circle back around and they do make, you know, a very...
Physicists often make this point, this sort of point anyway, not exactly the way you're saying, but the great architect of the universe is a mathematician, you know. Eugene Wigner talked about the uncanny relevance of the complex numbers in physics and so on. With a lot of discoveries, for instance, you know, Einstein, many of the things that are thought of as Einstein's discoveries, and they were Einstein's discoveries for real space, had been prefigured by the mathematicians often 100 years earlier. So the mathematicians were just doing it out of interest, and then it turned out to be relevant.
Genius at Play, The Curious Mind of John Horton Conway, is published now by Bloomsbury. And that's all we have for you this week. A big thank you to John Conway and Siobhan Roberts. From me, Ian Sample, and all the science team, thanks for listening.
This Guardian podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you want to build a website, you've got many options. But if you want to build it beautiful, there's only one. Squarespace gives you the power of world-class design so you can do more than create a website. You can set yourself apart. See why some of the world's most influential people, brands, and businesses choose Squarespace. To start your free trial, head to squarespace.com/guardian.